Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, a lot of the show is what I'm interested in, right? So I'm interested in ecology and exploration and aspects of the environment and certainly many areas of scientific research. And so the show today kind of sits at the nexus of all those things and covers a lot of it in an interesting way. Amazonia. You know what Amazonia is? The area of South America whose waterways drain into the Amazon River. And it's huge, nearly as big as the whole continental U.S. And until the 1900s, it was kind of like the dark continent of Africa was in the 1800s. It was largely unexplored by Europeans or Americans or South Americans of European descent. But for thousands of years, probably 12,000 or more, it had and still has to some extent today its own indigenous populations of what we commonly call Indians. And there were many different Stone Age tribes living all over the interior of Amazonia. And in recent years, archaeologists have come increasingly to think that the impact of these peoples on the Amazonian forest was once very large, leading to widespread landscape modification that they've started calling a manufactured ecosystem. My guest today is a biologist at the Florida Institute of Technology in Melbourne, Florida. His name is Professor Mark Bush, and he's been studying this idea with an international team of researchers to see if it's valid. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Court. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Good to have you on. So why don't we start by just, let me ask you to explain a little more about this manufactured ecosystem idea. It sounds to me a little highfalutin considering we're talking about something so huge and basically primitive people who are trying to keep themselves fed every day. But anyway, that is the kind of prevailing trend toward viewing Amazonia in the past. So how did the concept evolve and based on what evidence?
Right, well, you have to go back a little bit in time in terms of the archaeology. There was a prevailing view that almost there was no impact from these people. And so Betty Meggers was an archaeologist with the Smithsonian Institution, and she thought and she argued that the ancient peoples of Amazonia were just hunter-gatherers. They had a very light footprint on the forest. And she argued against any kind of cultural development amongst those people. As time went by, this is sort of in the 1950s and 1960s primarily, and as time went by, the evidence mounted that she was wrong, that there really were really significant cultural developments. There were organized cities, and if you have an organized city with walkways or with big structures within it, then someone had to build them, and that means that they were settled and that there was an organization afoot. And so the paradigm shifted from having the indigenous people having no impact to gradually just gaining momentum for this idea that the peoples there were actually far more sophisticated than previously thought. There were possibly very many more of them. Betty Meggers had thought that maybe there was 100,000 people in the Amazon basin, and some of the more recent estimates put that number as high as 8 million. This is all before the time of Columbus. And that the impact of these people went beyond just hunting and gathering. They were fish farming, they were creating weirs and berms and roadways, and they had organized village layouts. So a very different scenario. And from this whole idea, there then bloomed the next step, which was that, in fact, these people were pretty much all over the Amazon basin, and that they were deforesting the area, replanting it, or encouraging the growth of fruiting trees and useful trees, and that they were manipulating the landscape to their own needs. And so I got involved in this discussion about 5 years ago because I was concerned that there wasn't really the evidence to support that final step. The evidence for having a sophisticated set of cultures was really good, but going the next step to say this applied beyond where we know those villages were to the entire Amazon basin, that to me was the weaker step.
So just to be clear, we're not talking about the Mayans with their great temples or the Incas with, you know, Machu Picchu or whatever, and you know, or the Aztecs with those pyramids they made. I mean, we're not talking about those cultures. These are more Stone Age village people, right?
Yeah, so, you know, not really stone because they didn't have any stone there. In the Amazon basin,
okay.
That's part of the problem.
Wow.
Because, you know, in Central America and in the Andes, where you've got rocks and they were able to build all these massive structures, they're still there, so we can see them. But down in the Amazon basin, there's no surface rock there. So it's all going to be timber constructions or thatch or woven constructions. And so those things just degrade, and they really don't leave us any sense of what was there. And so the archaeology is far harder to work out in lots of ways. But they have left us other things instead. So they've left us modified soils, where they actually added carbon to the soil and made it much more fertile. They've left us smashed crockery and pots. They've left us the outline of where some of their huts that can actually be seen from space. As land gets cleared, some of the forest at the edge of the Amazon basin, as that gets cleared, we're starting to see unexplained structures, which are circles and squares that are called geoglyphs. And we really don't know what they were used for.
Yeah, so I mean, but what I meant was they're not really big, elaborate, sophisticated civilizations. It's more like village life. So what did you actually study then, given the fact that the jungle swallows everything? And as you say, it's very hard to do archaeological research there. And so you're trying to probe into this to see if the manufactured ecosystem idea holds up. So what did you study?
Right. So my research group decided that we would go out there, and rather than center on where a village is known to have been, an archaeological setting was known to have been, and then extrapolate from that, we wanted to do as much of a randomized study as we could. And that means going out into just pre-located, randomly located places, digging a soil pit and seeing if we see any evidence of people. And the evidence we were looking for was things like broken pottery, one of these modified soils. They're very black and they look very different from the native soils of the Amazon. We looked for charcoal particles, and we brought back samples of many samples per hole that we were digging there. And under the microscope, we sifted through and looked for charcoal particles. And then when we found charcoal, we would date it using radiocarbon dating. And the importance of charcoal there is that certainly in the western Amazon, there's no natural fire. And so if we find charcoal particles, it's almost a certain indicator that there were people there in the past. And by directly dating the charcoal particle, we get a good estimate of when that fire was. And so we did this for 500 sites across the Amazon. In all that, what we found was nothing. Well, that's not quite true. We didn't find any broken pottery. We didn't find any modified soils, but we did find charcoal. And we found charcoal alongside the rivers. And then when you went back away from the river, you got less and less charcoal. And by the time you'd done a day's walk in from the river, which is about 9 kilometers, or 5 miles, say, then there was basically no charcoal there. We were able to make a prediction from this that the people were concentrated along the waterways. And then when we went back and we looked to see where the soils have been modified, where previously other people have found these modified soils, they fit with this expectation exactly. They were all along the rivers. They weren't in the areas, the interfluvial areas between the rivers. And so, you know, that was our starting point, really. We made that assessment. We did some statistical modeling and so on, and we went back and we did some more analyses and tested it again, and it seemed to hold up. And so then we got in touch with other people working in other fields to say, are our data consistent with what you find in terms of mammal densities and other fire records from the Amazon? And that's where this group of researchers came together that has just published a paper in the Journal of Biogeography where we're arguing that, in fact, this manufactured landscape is an overstatement if you try and apply it away from the rivers.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Professor Mark Bush at the Florida Institute of Technology. He's a biologist there and an ecologist there who has been studying with an international team of researchers how much, basically, the early humans altered the Amazon basin. And their kind of findings argue against a growing idea that there was a huge impact of humans throughout Amazonia, and it's more like really just a small impact along the rivers. So I think, Mark, that there's a kind of political implication to this whole thing because it's tied to the question in the countries that own parts of Amazonia, Brazil and others, of how much you can log the Amazon and develop it and you know, do timbering in it. And so why don't you explain that background to this whole question and why it elevates the importance of this beyond just the scientific knowledge of it?
Right. Well, there's several components to that. One is that indigenous rights can be influenced. At least it's been an argument that if people have been controlling the landscape in the past, then it strengthens their indigenous rights to the land today. We certainly don't want to get in the way of indigenous rights, but we do have to be very careful as scientists not to let our social preferences stand in the way of what we think is actually the truth of things. But conservation is absolutely at the heart of this discussion, because if the folks who argue for a manufactured landscape are correct, then the argument is that a lot of that Amazon basin is only one tree generation. Trees live for 300, 400, 500 years. It's only one tree generation away from having been used in a very different way than we see it today. And so you could then argue, okay, well, we can go and we can cut down these forests because they'll grow back. They did before. And so to me, it's an argument then that if it was a manufactured landscape, the modern system is not really a very fragile system. It's something which can regrow quite readily. If, on the other hand, they're wrong and we are correct, then the vast majority of the Amazon rainforest has not been cut and reestablished within just the last 500 years. We're actually dealing with a system which is potentially 10 million years old, something like that, and that it really could be very much more vulnerable. And so there's sort of a swing of a pendulum argument here, and it's not symmetrical. If the manufactured landscape folks are wrong, then when you go in and you cut down the rainforest, it won't grow back. If, on the other hand, we are wrong, then you go in and you protect the rainforest. The very worst that you've done is you've protected the rainforest from being used until we have better knowledge. Mm. And then maybe they're right and I'm wrong, and you can go ahead and use it. But there's an asymmetry about the outcome if either side is wrong.
What's your feeling? I mean, if you step back from this particular question, which is kind of theoretical or speculative, right? If you step back from that and look at it as a biologist who's familiar with the Amazon forest and with some cutting and burning that's been done there, I mean, a lot of it that's been done there already, which you've seen some of, I assume, what's your feeling about that? Your gut feeling is that you could selectively deforest or cut or log the Amazon and it would kind of come back, or is it fragile? What do you think, just at a gut level?
I think that it depends a little bit on how fussy you are about what you want at the end of this. If there are plenty of forests around the world which have been selectively logged in the past, and they will regrow to look like a good forest, and you'll have quite a lot of animals in them. So perhaps from an ecotourism level, you can still go in there and you can still see the forest as it was, and you'll still see some monkeys and things, and maybe be perfectly happy with that. But I see just this enormous difference. There's a river that I take students down in a summer field program, and it's called the Madre de Dios in Peru. And if we go through the area of that where there's hunting allowed, we really see almost nothing. You'll see some macaws flying over the river if you're lucky, and you maybe see a capybara or some of the rodents along the riverbank. But as soon as we go past the ranger station, where they stop the hunters going in and there really is good protection, then we see jaguar, we see giant river otters, we see the top predators of that system that have just been eliminated everywhere else. And so I think, conservation of these systems, it requires complete protection, not partial protection. You'll still have a forest, it'll still sequester carbon, it'll still meet some of our ecosystem needs, but it is not the same as the wild forest.
Yeah, that's just common sense. Science lives, today in the real world much more than it used to in the past, and is often not as objective as we'd like to think. And sometimes it's attached to economic motives. We see that in, various aspects of the economy. Is the manufactured ecosystem idea partly driven by logging and development interests? I mean, who funds a lot of the research in this area? And who funds your research, for that matter?
I don't believe it is. I mean, I think the archaeologists are absolutely honest in their assessment. We just have a philosophical disagreement about what the data mean at present.
Okay.
And that's partly because there are so few data points in the Amazon. No, I mean, the archaeologists and the anthropologists who are arguing for a manufactured landscape are some of the staunchest supporters of the indigenous rights of folks, and I think really this is a product of a lack of funding rather than anyone putting money into the discussion. My funding comes from the National Science Foundation for doing this work. I believe that the National Science Foundation also funds some of the archaeologists who are doing their things.
Okay, well, that's encouraging.
I don't think there's a sort of an evil twist to this at all. One of the slightly curious things was some years ago, we actually published the first evidence from the Dariena, Panama, that place was not pristine and that there had been maize agriculture there. And that's when I got sensitized to this, because our publication, which was done just as an academic publication, published in an academic journal, got picked up by the timber corporation. And they started to argue that based off what we had described in terms of maize agriculture, that should allow them to go in and log sections of the Darien which had never been logged before. And that's absolutely not what we meant, nor is it correct. But nevertheless, that's how it got used.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's what happens in the real world, right? So what were some of the most sophisticated cultures in Amazonia in the past? I said it was not the Mayans who were kind of in Central America or the Incas that were up in the Andes, but there were a lot of different tribes. What were some of those that were most developed as we would view it?
I'm not sure they had names that we would associate with today, because a lot of the people who occupy the same sites today are not necessarily derived from the blood lineages of people who were there before.
Okay.
There was so much dislocation in the Amazon basin that there's been turnover in a lot of those settings. But some of the key cultures were in the Xingu River Basin, in the sort of the headwaters area there, the upper reaches. And so those are known as the Xinguanos. Then there's another whole group at near Santarém in the center of Brazil. And then there's others who are right out on the, almost to the edge of the Amazon where it meets the Atlantic, on the islands there. There are discrete groups that were culturally, linguistically very different. And, you know, the original records, the one record of an eyewitness account that we have going down the river, tells of going from chiefdom to chiefdom to chiefdom, and that they had their different characters. Some were friendly, some were very hostile, and so on. So it is very complex.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, the remains you see, or the remnants, are you know, holes in the ground or pieces of, you know, clumps of charcoal and things like that that are just very subtle. But are there any at all that are not so subtle? I mean, where you can at least see the foundation of a large building somewhere? Is there anything like that anywhere in the Amazonia?
The most obvious thing are these geoglyphs that are showing up now in Rondônia and down into Bolivia. And those are earth structures. They're sort of probably about 2 meters to 3 meters high, and they may be a raised ring where they've thrown up the dirt and to create this ring. But it's an almost perfect circle or an almost perfect rectangle. These may be 100 meters or 200 meters across. And so if you go into Google Earth, you can actually see them. If you zoom in, you can see these structures just popping up at near the edge of the forest there. There's no buildings or anything like that.
So there aren't kitchen middens and what we call Indian mounds. I mean, there aren't, like there are in South Florida, large mounds of oyster shells. There aren't mollusk, you know, mussel shells and things like that, where there clearly are structures that are, even if they're just, you know, landfills today, there aren't things like that?
Yes, there are. There are midden sites. And some of these modified soils are almost similar to those middens in the sense that they've broken an immense amount of pottery and added it to the soil.
Hmm.
And they were either incredibly clumsy people,
yeah,
or there was actually a method to what they were doing. And the suggestion is that these clay fragments actually helped to bind nutrients in the soil into that setting. But quite clearly, some of these were just refuse mounds as well that accumulated where they live, because they've got fish bone in them, and they've got pot sherds, and they've got scraps of their day-to-day living, seeds and discarded remains that still sit there.
So you mentioned seeing some of these sites from space, I guess Google Earth or something, but do you do all of this research on the ground, or do you also fly over maybe in a small plane and look for signs of former habitation?
We do all our stuff from the ground. We use satellite imagery extensively to help find where we're going to go, and most of what we're doing in this particular project, we were just going to these preordained random locations. For a lot of the other work that I do, we're finding ancient lakes, and then we drill into the sediments of ancient lakes and reconstruct very detailed histories from those. And so we're always trying to find a new lake that hasn't been described by science before.
Do you ever rely on local guides who may know where something is back in the bush that you couldn't find otherwise?
In the past, absolutely. That's how a lot of these lakes were discovered. More recently, we find that the satellite imagery sometimes tells us that there's a lake there that the local people don't know about. We've just finished working on a lake like that, which is right on the edge of the Amazon Basin, and we went to the village and asked permission to go upriver to where there were semi-contacted Indians. So we have this sort of gradation amongst the Indians. Those who are fully contacted, that means that they have probably wear Western clothing and use Western goods. And semi-contacted, as the name suggests, they may have taken on some of the attributes, but they are living sort of away from Western influence as much as possible. And then there's the truly uncontacted, which you really don't want to have anything to do with because they're likely to shoot you with arrows because they're so scared of disease and everything else.
Yeah, well, I would hope you would leave them uncontacted. I mean, occasionally we see a photo, you know, in the news taken from a plane of a small clearing in the jungle and a few members of an uncontacted Amazonian tribe are staring up at the plane and running around and threatening to shoot at it with arrows, and poor guys are terrified. You know, this might be a UFO as far as they're concerned. So how many pockets of uncontacted people do you think are left in Amazonia, and are they actually protected from contact? I would hope that people can't just kind of walk in and barge in and go, hey, cough, cough, and kill them all, you know?
Right. Well, it's I think it's a relatively small number at this point. There are some who are sort of fairly well known in the sense that we all know that they're there and everyone tries to stay away from them. But there's a group in Peru who have been coming down to this river. I mean, for example, this last summer I took students on the Madre de Dios. We were not allowed on the north bank of the river to go to some lakes which we'd gone to before because the uncontacted had started moving through that area. And so the local guides, you know where to exclude you from to try and keep you away. But those people are dangerous. I mean, they don't quite know how to deal with Western influences. And so the Peruvian government sent in two translators to try and help them. These were, you know, other native people to try and help bridge to these folks. And they were killed. By the same token, it seems like these uncontacted people, particularly this group in Peru, actually want to be assimilated to some extent. They just don't know quite how to do it.
Yeah, I would say we're more dangerous.
Yeah, we're way more dangerous to them, absolutely, than they are to us.
So if you had to guess, how much of Amazonia do you think was actually significantly affected by early humans percentage-wise? I mean, is it tiny, like, you know, 1%, or is it more like 10? Or
I think it's a really hard thing to say for sure. Early days in this whole investigation, really. Again, a gut feeling about it. I think you'd have probably 10% would be quite actively either the mammals reduced in their numbers because of hunting pressure, or there would have been some change in the forest structure because of people there. And then there may be another, maybe 20%. I don't know. I just, you know, that's a number out of thin air. For where people were operating, but on a very occasional basis, and so they were almost having no greater impact, say, than any other large mammal would. So I think, you know, it's very difficult to say that there was never any point in the Amazon Basin where a human has never been. That's a lot of negatives in one sentence. And I think there's a finite probability that people were almost anywhere. Whether they have much of an influence there, I very much doubt.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's a huge place, and, you know, probably somebody sometime set off and made a trail
They hunted a monkey or two and then moved on. And so, it then becomes, do you think that is a human impact or not? And so, you know, we would argue that is not. That is no different, really, from having a jaguar go through it.
Yeah, sure.
When people start to burn the forest systematically, or when they start to put down roots and change a system, then obviously that becomes a very different thing.
So you mentioned that you found impacts, the charcoal remnants, about 5 miles back from rivers. So just briefly, were they major waterways that that were generally just close to the Amazon itself? I mean, was the Amazon the core the spine of this whole thing, or was it rivers that went way up from the Amazon into Amazonia?
Well, even these smaller rivers are big by our standards. You know, if you think of something like the Ohio River or something like that, I mean, there's plenty of tributary rivers to the Amazon which are way bigger than the Ohio. So we were trying to define a river as being any water body that was navigable year-round. And so, yes, we're not mapping the teeny, tiny, twisting little tributaries, but, you know, sort of the bigger water bodies seem to be what these people preferred. What they really wanted as a setting was a river bluff, a cliff where they could be up above the river so they didn't get wet if it flooded. They could look out and look for enemies, could control an area. So in where rivers joined, and there's a bluff there, that's absolutely a perfect place to find these people. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's quite predictable where these folks were to a large extent.
Well, Mark, we're down to just a minute or so left, but just very briefly, you're a biologist, and I see terms like paleoecology and biogeography used to describe this kind of research. And it sounds like it's inherently interdisciplinary. So what kinds of specialists, again, briefly, are on your research team?
We specialize in fossil pollen, diatoms, charcoal, midges, and we use those to reconstruct fossil histories. We also work with archaeologists and anthropologists and folks who look at the use of animals in diet and how hunters access their prey and the extent to which they do so.
Sounds interesting. And they're international, too. They're people from different countries.
And I left out, we have a whole group there who also work on satellite imaging and remote sensing and the modeling component of what we do, too. Yeah, so this, you know, very international, Peruvians, Brazilians, Brits, all kinds of folks in this venture.
Well, it's good. It's interesting stuff and has, you know, big implications. And, you know, it's the biggest large natural area left on Earth. And, you know, it's a huge carbon sink, as Mark mentioned. And it's important to the climate and the future of Earth, right? Just the same as the Arctic ice caps are, which are in trouble now, right? So it's a big deal.
Absolutely. I would just say that, you know, we are the generation that is going to decide really whether the biodiversity of Amazonia disappears or continues to exist.
There you go. To learn more about what Mark Bush and his team study, go to research.fit, that's Florida Institute of Technology, FIT.edu. So research.fit.edu/paleolab, PALEOLAB. You can read more about this particular study by going to NSF.gov, that's for the National Science Foundation, NSF.gov, and searching for the term Amazon Forest, and this will pop up as the top link. So, Mark Bush, I want to thank you so much for being on with us in American Variety.
It's been my pleasure, Court. Thanks so much for your time.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.